80-year-old Benjamin Pensner and his 16-year-old sister Jessica answered a call from the Pacifica Radio Archives to participate in a time capsule project. Their story and others will be maintained and cataloged in the archives and the Library of Congress to be reopened and rebroadcast in 2059. If you'd like to say something to people 50 years from now about your life as an LGBT person, wherever you are in the world, you can submit your story, song, poem, video, or audio email to gayday@kpfk.org or call 1-800-735-0230. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Pam Marshall, Chris Wilson, Rex Walker with Bill Kelly, and Judd Proctor and Brian Burns with Giz Bo contributed program material. Thanks also to the Pacifica Radio Archives. Benjamin Pensner performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is underwritten in part by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through donations from our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to support our work, hear our podcasts, or subscribe to CDs of our programs. To receive our weekly program email alerts, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on WLUW Chicago, Illinois, Planet FM Auckland, New Zealand, KRCL Salt Lake City, Utah, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. And we're all going to stay tuned.
You can catch This Way Out every Monday between 7:30 and 8 p.m. here on Monday evenings. This is WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk, New York at 88.7 FM. Stay tuned next for Counterpoint coming up right away. But first, we bring you the second in a series of the revival of the White Rose political calendar, thanks to producer Melinda Tuhus. So stay tuned for that. We'll be back with Counterpoint in just a few minutes.
Welcome to this week's edition of the White Rose Political Calendar. The calendar takes its name from the White Rose, a resistance group in Nazi Germany that worked to educate and organize opposition to the horrifying agenda of the Third Reich. In the spirit of the White Rose, WPKN offers its weekly political calendar in order to give voice to the struggles for political, social, economic, and environmental justice. Here are this week's listings. On Thursday, July 16th, from 6 to 10 p.m., join Arte Inc. at its annual auction fundraiser at Anthony's Ocean View, 450 Lighthouse Road, New Haven. Auction items include original artwork, vacation apartment in Argentina, vacation condos in Puerto Rico and Vermont, theater tickets, dinners, CDs, gift and liquor baskets, musical instruments signed by El Gran Combo and others, canoeing lessons, dance lessons, and many more items. All proceeds benefit Arte Inc.'s scholarship fund and programs. Arte is dedicated to promoting Latino art, culture, and talent. Arte establishes partnerships with community agencies and groups to improve the quality of life of residents. Contact Arte for details and tickets at 203-787-2783. That's 203-787-2783. Or visit their website at arte-inc.com. That's arte-inc.com. Bike to Work, Friday, July 17th. Elm City Cycling and Brew Cafe are sponsoring this month's free Bike to Work Day breakfast for all cyclists. It's outside New Haven City Hall, 165 Church Street, across from the Green. Come anytime between 7:30 and 9:30 a.m. Check out our cycling attire fashion show, clothes for all kinds of commuting. Plus, learn about bike security systems and get security tips from the Devil's Gear Bike Shop. Contact us in advance to get a cycling buddy. For more information, email bicyclenewhaven@gmail.com. That's bicyclenewhaven@gmail.com. Or visit our website at elmcitycycling.org. The Solar Energy Association of Connecticut invites you to an on-site demonstration and discussion of biodiesel for cars and home heating and a solar electric system on Saturday, July 18th at Flemig Farm, 7 Shingle Mill Road, West Simsbury, Connecticut. Biodiesel for cars and home heating will be discussed by David Henry and Nevin Christensen, specialists in biodiesel. Transportation and home heating are major energy users. Alternatives to the conventional petroleum-based vehicles and heating systems are urgently needed. In addition to answering basic questions about biofuels, the speakers will demonstrate a biodiesel processor, which converts vegetable oil to biodiesel. A solar electric PV system at this farm will also be shown and discussed. The Solar Energy Association of Connecticut, Inc. is a nonprofit educational organization active since 1976 that supports and promotes the use of renewable energies and environmentally acceptable technologies. This event is free and open to the public, but registration is requested by calling 860-233-5684. That's 860-233-5684. For more information, visit the group's website at solarenergyofct.org. That's solarenergyofct.org. On July 19th, from 1 to 4 p.m., it's a picnic potluck, rain or shine. Come celebrate the 25th anniversary of the New Haven-Leon Sister City Project and the 30th anniversary of the triumph of the Nicaraguan Revolution, the triumph of the people of Nicaragua over the 40-year dictatorship of the Somoza family. The Sister City Project is a progressive, binational, grassroots organization that fosters a relationship between the communities of Greater New Haven and Leon, Nicaragua. There will be live music and a speaker. Help us make it green. Bring your own utensils, plate, cup, and napkin. It's at the home of Allie Perry and Charlie Pillsbury, 247 St. Ronan Street, New Haven. RSVP yes only to Patty at 203-562-1607. That's 203-562-1607. Or email P. Newelson. That's P-N-U-E-L-S-E-N at newhavenleon.org. newhavenleon.org. This week's calendar was produced by Melinda Tuhus.
And again, that's the White Rose calendar, which we had been missing for a little bit more than a year. Very happy to have it back as a feature of this show and other programming here on WPKN as a way to get an activist calendar back on the air that had been going on since 1991 with some hiatuses here and there. But thanks to Melinda, it's back on the air. And I would just please remind anyone listening who's connected with an organization or maybe even aware of an event that more people in this audience should know about, please write to the White Rose Calendar, and our website will have a way you can email the White Rose Calendar directly. But keep in mind that it's a good way to publicize an event coming up, and as it's been gone for a year, it's a reminder here I want to give you all. But right now, I want to let you know Counterpoint's coming up next, and we have a number of guests this evening, including Jim Lyons, Vice President for Policy and Communication with Oxfam America, will be reviewing what happened at the G8 summit in Italy regarding global climate change and hunger. Hector Perla, an assistant professor of Latin American and Latino studies at University of California, will be here to talk about ongoing efforts to resolve the removal of office of Manuel Zelaya, the Honduran president, through a coup d'etat. A little later, John Isaacs will be here to talk about Barack Obama's negotiations with the Russians over a reduction of nuclear weapons. And lastly tonight, we're going to be talking with John Wasik about his new book, The Cul-de-Sac Syndrome, Turning Around the Unsustainable American Dream, where he's going to take a critical look and rethinking the single-family home and resulting suburban sprawl. So all those topics are up next. Please stay with us.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds, snakes, an airplane. Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I have a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Turn world serves its own needs. Dummies serve your own needs. Beat it up and not speak. Fire in the combat zone.
Good evening and welcome to Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris, here every Monday evening, and very happy to be with you this Monday night. We have a number of guests, as I just ran down a couple of moments ago, to talk about a variety of topics, including the coup d'etat in Honduras, the issues of arms control and reducing the nuclear weapons arsenal between the U.S. and Russia, and turning around the unsustainable American dream, a discussion of the book Cul-de-sac Syndrome about the mortgage crisis, but more importantly, the model of housing in this country, which has been disastrous for many. But right now I'd like to introduce to you Jim Lyons. He's Vice President for Policy and Communications with the group Oxfam America. Jim, thanks so much for being here with us tonight.
My pleasure, Scott.
Before we get into a discussion of the G8 summit that took place in Italy last week, tell our listeners who certainly have heard of Oxfam, but tell them more explicitly what the group's agenda is, what your mission is.
Sure. Well, Oxfam is an organization that has been in existence for decades. Oxfam America is one of 14 Oxfams around the world who collectively work to address issues of humanitarian concern and international development. And our goal is to alleviate poverty and end injustice, which sounds like a tall order, but we do so by programs working in 120 countries around the world, working with local organizations to increase their capacity to feed themselves, to deal with disease, to address crises. The tsunami is an example, and Hurricane Katrina in the southeastern United States. So we're an organization that really is focused on trying to empower people to help themselves, lift themselves out of poverty, and make a better life for themselves and for their future by helping them to restore and sustain their basic human rights.
So, Jim, on the G8 summit, which is an event that took place in Italy, it involved not just the eight preeminent industrial nations of the world, but I believe a total of 17 nations that came together to look at some of the world's intractable problems. I know that from the perspective of your organization, environmental groups and other social justice groups, they were looking to these nations participating in G8 for leadership on cutting greenhouse gas emissions that produce global warming, as well as leadership on addressing the poverty issue in Africa in particular, but generally around the world. There's a lot of disappointment there. You want to tell our listeners, sort of in nutshell form, what were the major grievances with the G8 nations in the summit?
Well, to focus on the first issue mentioned, climate change, there's been a continuing disagreement about how to achieve the reductions in CO2 emissions that are necessary to avoid the continued impact of global warming, which is now being felt across the globe. Those disagreements center around how large the emission reduction should be in particular countries, particularly in the developed world, which is responsible for most of the emissions, and also how to help developing countries both deal with the consequences of climate change that they're feeling, while at the same time realizing their desire to be able to grow and develop as developed nations have, so as to ensure that as they grow, they don't further contribute to greenhouse gases and to global warming. So, for that issue, actually, there was some progress made at the G8 meeting, and we can go into that in greater detail. I think another area of concern, obviously, is poverty, and the global financial crisis has pushed more nations, more people into poverty. I mean, here in the United States, people are feeling the consequences of unemployment and the financial collapse. But imagine the situation for someone living in a developing country. In many instances, dependent on a dollar a day for their living. When markets collapse, it has a devastating impact on the ability of people to survive, with the cost of fertilizer and seed and other essentials increasing. It makes it very difficult for many of these people to survive. So an important issue raised at the G8 and addressed there was the issue of how to deal, in particular, with food security and to improve people's ability to feed themselves and hopefully, as markets turn around, realize economic gain and sustainable livelihoods from investments there. And there was some very positive news. So while some of the larger issues of poverty and the impacts of the global financial crisis on Africa in particular were not raised, certainly the issue of climate change got a great deal of attention. And I think to the surprise of many, a substantial financial commitment was made by the G8 to reinvest in supporting agricultural development towards averting the next global food crisis.
You want to talk more specifically about global climate change and what were some of the agreements reached at the G8 summit in Italy last week?
Well, I think the most significant agreement there was really the commitment to avoid an increase in global temperatures beyond 2 degrees Celsius. Now, this was kind of the scientific consensus, the benchmark against which all commitments to deal with global warming have been measured. And really what came out of that meeting, which was so significant, was this agreement to cut emissions so as to avoid passing that threshold of 2 degrees Celsius. Basically, what the G8 collectively agreed to was an 80% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions over the next 40 years, so as to limit overall temperature increases to less than 4 degrees Fahrenheit, which is about 2 degrees Celsius above 1990 levels. That was the good news. The bad news is that how we get there, what developed nations and developing nations will need to do to avoid exceeding that 2 degree mark has not yet been agreed to. Although President Obama and the G8 leaders committed to work between now and the international meeting in Copenhagen, when negotiations are intended to come to resolution and agreement reached on a post-2012 climate agreement, when they will occur.
Jim Lyons is our guest, Vice President for Policy and Communication with Oxfam America, and we're talking about the G8 summit in Italy. And, Jim, when it comes to the developing nations of the world, there are some leaders of the industrial nations who cast blame on the developing world for not coming up with a stronger agreement on addressing global climate change. What's your response on that?
Well, I think you can understand the position of the developing world, countries like China and India, Brazil, who are realizing growth, China, obviously substantial economic growth, still have millions of people who live in poverty. Their per capita emissions of greenhouse gases are considerably less than developed countries like the United States, which happens to have the highest per capita emissions. So there's a great deal of hesitancy on the part of the developing countries to commit to a cap on emissions, which would affect them, for fear it could thwart their efforts to try and raise their own populations out of poverty and to realize some of the gains and benefits that we recognize and appreciate here in the developed world. I think a great deal of the debate obviously centers around the role of China, a growing economy. And with that growth, they've been accused of adding to greenhouse gas emissions by building coal-fired power plants to fuel their economy. I think what's significant is that China is in fact also growing in the development of green technologies and technologies that will realize or produce less greenhouse gas emissions based on renewables, solar, wind, geothermal, and the like. But this has been an area of disagreement and obviously continues to be an area of disagreement since the developing countries represented at the Italian G8 meeting were unwilling to commit to a cap on emissions unless they received assistance in developing the green technologies that would allow their economies to grow without increasing their emissions. And they received assistance in dealing with the consequences of climate change, which heretofore they've been least responsible for, but unfortunately, given their economic circumstances, are most vulnerable to.
So the response of the industrial nations was to say no to aid, or was there any room for compromise there at the meeting that may come to fruition later on?
No, in fact, and I think this was an important step for President Obama. The G8 ministers, in part pushed by the president and his administration, agreed to commit their finance ministers to develop mechanisms to finance assistance for adaptation for developing countries. This has been a significant issue going way back to the first meeting on the new international agreement, which occurred in Bali. Some referred to the Bali Roadmap, made clear that developing countries would seek assistance, as I said, both in helping to develop clean forms of energy and also in dealing with the consequences of climate change for their agricultural production, for water shortages, for the health impacts and related impacts that are the result of increased global temperatures. So there's no surprise to see this, but to some degree, this is perhaps the posturing that goes into the press of negotiations as the Copenhagen meeting approaches this December.
Jim Lyons, there are over a billion people around the world that go to bed hungry every night. And if you could explain to our listeners a bit about the link between hunger, agricultural problems and failures of agriculture around the world and climate change.
Well, let's start with agriculture. I don't know that many people know. I really hadn't focused on this, though I've worked in agriculture for many years, but 70% of the world's poor depend on agriculture for their livelihoods. So agriculture is essential for feeding themselves and also for generating, in many instances, the meager income that's necessary to sustain themselves, to put their children in school, to realize any kind of health care that may be available. So agriculture is critical. And unfortunately, over the past two decades, assistance for agricultural development, that is assistance to help farmers overseas, and many of these are small landowners, what we refer to as smallholder farmers, help them realize a living, help them get the assistance, the technical assistance and support they need to be able to at least sustain their families and try and realize some economic gain from agriculture. That agricultural assistance has declined precipitously. In the 80s, nearly 75% more funding overseas assistance was available for agriculture than exists today. Only about $4 billion is actually provided in terms of global aid for agriculture. As a result, we've seen increased problems in food aid, increased starvation, and problems with hunger, which we've addressed through food aid. And developed countries have provided food assistance to help people feed themselves. Well, that is certainly a way to deal with the crisis associated with lack of food. It does nothing to help those communities and those countries develop their own capacity to feed themselves. And in fact, in some ways, it may thwart that ability because the food that's transported to those countries and is available sometimes can undercut the price of food that's locally produced and therefore creates a disincentive for actually agriculture. critical things is to try and reinvest in agricultural production and actually move nations away from needing aid but to a position where they're actually able to feed themselves. And this has actually been part of the agricultural initiative that was announced by the president. In fact, when the president went to Ghana following the G8 meeting and spoke to the Ghanaian parliament, he made note of the fact that the purpose of foreign assistance was to create the conditions where it's no longer needed. And this $20 billion commitment of food, of agricultural development assistance may help in that regard. Now, adding to the difficulty of meeting basic agricultural needs and food production needs is, of course, climate change. With climate change, there's been increased recognition that agriculture will suffer. And in fact, across Africa, we've estimated that 75 to 250 million people could face severe water shortages by 2020, one of the consequences of climate change. Now, obviously, water is essential for agricultural production, and severe weather, droughts, or even floods in certain circumstances could destroy any effort for people to feed themselves. So dealing with climate change and at the same time providing assistance to help small communities in developing countries develop the infrastructure and the capacity to feed themselves is critical. So the two issues are clearly linked, and it's essential that that development assistance and a commitment to reduce greenhouse gas emissions work hand in hand if people are ever going to be able to lift themselves out of poverty and begin to feed themselves.
Jim, to sum up, what can our listeners do to put pressure on our own government here in the United States to do more with other nations in addressing climate change in the lead up to the Copenhagen Climate Change Summit, as well as the food aid and the agricultural issues that you just addressed in terms of poverty and hunger, which the industrial nations have not stepped up, in the opinion of Oxfam and others, as much as they should? What can our listeners do?
Well, simple answer to that, and that is to communicate to their elected leaders, members of Congress, to the administration, that it's essential that that they follow through on food aid commitments made by President Obama, who committed $3.5 billion in agricultural assistance over the next 3 years. That's a significant increase and reverses the trend I talked about. But it's essential that that the Congress see fit to provide those funds. Not an easy task given the financial straits that many Americans face, but really essential if we're going to help lift people out of poverty, help alleviate future humanitarian disasters, and really help strengthen the economies of developing countries so that ultimately they can become trading partners with the United States, which will benefit our economy and our own security as well. On climate change, a very similar message. It's critical that we get strong leadership from the president and strong legislation from the Congress to put us on a path that will help reduce our own greenhouse gas emissions and also make essential investments in the development of renewable sources of energy, wind, solar, geothermal, biofuels. While a bill recently passed the House of Representatives, the Waxman-Markey bill, which calls for a substantial reduction in greenhouse gas emissions and significant investments in renewable sources of energy, by all expectations, a real battle will unfold in the Senate where it could be that much more difficult to pass legislation that puts the United States on the right path and, in fact, reaffirms U.S. leadership in dealing with this global environmental challenge. So a message to members of Congress about how essential it is to both realize that that food aid commitment and to pass strong legislation that will reduce greenhouse gas emissions is really essential, and essential right now if by the time we get to Copenhagen the U.S. is in a position to deal with a strong hand to achieve essential reductions in greenhouse gas emissions and to provide the necessary funding to help developing countries avoid future humanitarian disasters and by helping them deal with the consequences of climate change.
Well, Jim, thanks. And just a quick comment, you know, on the Waxman-Markey cap-and-trade carbon reduction bill, you know, a lot of environmental groups are very disappointed with that and you know, feeling that it was watered down to the point of meaninglessness. There is some hope that if it is passed, and as you said, even with this watered down version, there's a lot of battles ahead even for that bill. But people like President Obama talk about, well, just get this bill passed and we can strengthen it later on. I don't know how much time we have with global warming, and there's a lot of dire predictions from many scientists who are saying that the threat of global warming and you know, dramatic climate change and severe weather are the things you addressed in terms of agriculture and feeding ourselves are escalating at a point they hadn't even imagined a few years ago. So it seems like this issue is becoming more immediate every day.
I couldn't agree more, Scott. I will say this: to have an administration in office that not only recognizes climate change as a concern but has made it one of its top priorities is, in my mind, an essential first step for moving forward. And while I know many of us would have liked to have seen a stronger bill come out of the House, it is so essential that we get a strong bill out of the Senate and send a very clear signal and provide support for the administration to negotiate an approach to dealing with climate change that does achieve those 80% reductions in greenhouse gas emissions that are so essential.
Well, Jim, thanks for spending time with us tonight. And leave our listeners, if you would, with a phone number, web address, other resources our listeners could tap into to get more information on the topics that we discussed here tonight.
Well, sure. Best just to go to our website. It's www.oxfamamerica.org. And there you can get information about these issues and the other issues that we work on. You know, we'll continue to follow these issues, including the upcoming UN meeting in New York, which will bring focus again to climate, and then the G20 meeting, which will be hosted by President Obama in Pittsburgh in September. Those are two important milestones on the journey to Copenhagen. So important opportunities to again weigh in and have your voices heard at a critical time.
All right, Jim. Well, thanks again, and we appreciate you being here tonight. We'll go on again, I hope, to talk more about these same issues.
Great, Scott. Appreciate it. Have a good night.
Good night, Jim. Bye-bye. That was Jim Lyons, Vice President for Policy and Communication with Oxfam America. Their web address, again, is oxfamamerica.org. We'll be back talking about the coup in Honduras in just a few minutes. Stay tuned.
save. Gonna be a close shave. Stay brave, jump the grave. Gotta save what we can save. Slow down fast. Slow down fast.
Light the lava lamp. Here comes the concert you've been waiting for. The Electric Prunes. Love with Johnny Eccles and Baby Lemonade. And the Blues Magoos as they turn the clock back to music of California in 1966. Hear the music that started it all in a one-time live show as only the people that created it all can present. This is not a tribute or a copy. This is the real thing. The Electric Prunes, Love, the Blues Magoos, California 66. This may be your last chance. California 66 is a benefit concert for WPKN Radio on Thursday, August 6th at the Quick Center, Fairfield University in Fairfield, Connecticut. Tickets are available online at quickcenter.com or through the box office at 203-254-4010. California 66 benefit tickets are $66 for adults and $33 for students and are tax deductible to the extent allowed. This benefit concert for WPKN is dedicated to the late Sky Saxon from the Seeds.
That's coming up August 6th, a benefit concert for WPKN, the Electric Prunes, the Blues Magoos, and Love. Hadn't heard those names in a long time, but fascinating stuff. I hope you'll come out to that August 6th at the Quick Center at Fairfield University. Again, a benefit for WPKN. You can call the station for more information. That's 203-331-9756. Here in Counterpoint, my name is Scott Harris, and I'd like to welcome to the program right now Hector Perla, Assistant Professor of Latin American and Latino Studies at the University of California at Santa Cruz. Professor Perla, thanks so much for being here tonight.
Hi, Scott. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
I wonder if you can just sort of recap for us the status of negotiations right now. We know that Costa Rican President Oscar Arias, who was engaged in a lot of negotiations around the Central America wars in the 1980s, was asked to come into the negotiations between the de facto government of Honduras and the democratically elected president of Honduras, who was ousted in a coup back in late June. And that's Manuel Zelaya.
That's right.
Can you give us an update here of what we know is going on between the two sides? I think they've met delegations have met at least once or twice in Costa Rica.
Yeah, so that's pretty much right. They've met one time, as far as I know. The president, the constitutional president, Zelaya, met with Arias individually. Then Micheletti, the de facto president, met with Arias individually, but they never met face-to-face. The three of them never met face-to-face. And then subsequently, what's been going on is they've left kind of working teams kind of trying to hammer things out at lower levels, but nothing, no real new meeting again. And so there were the next round of meetings was scheduled, Micheletti was proposing July 18th, and just recently, actually, I believe earlier today, Zelaya came out and issued an ultimatum to the de facto government, basically saying that either you carry out the OAS and United Nations approved resolutions at the next meeting that's going to be held later this week, or we will consider the negotiations dead and a failure. And then we'll move on to the next round of kinds of figuring out if what are the next sanctions or if there's anything that they can do through other means.
So, Hector Perla, what is the Obama administration doing right now? It seems that, in one sense, they're trying to take a back seat to more cooperation in addressing this issue among Latin American nations together rather than taking a leading role here. But what effectively has President Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton done here to restore Zelaya to power?
Well, this is a difficult question. I mean, I would that characterized the Obama's administration's response as kind of foot dragging is the best way to describe what I consider how they've responded. For instance, in the first few days, in the first day or two, when all the other countries of the world were condemning the coup, President Obama said he was concerned. He didn't go on to label it as a coup until a few days later, and then began to state that they recognized Zelaya as the only legitimate government. But they had not pulled any kind of military aid, and they still to this date have not pulled out the ambassador. They've also left in place the so-called humanitarian aid, which, you know, oftentimes in situations like this can be used to prop up governments that are otherwise trying to be pressured. So it is difficult. It is a difficult situation, but I would characterize it as somewhat foot-dragging. There's this sense like they're not being proactive. They're not using the kind of the stature and legitimacy of the United States that the United States has in the region to effectively enforce international law.
So, Hector Perla, is that a sign that the Obama administration is trying to let other nations of Latin America and Central America come together to resolve this issue themselves? Or is there a hidden agenda there that secretly wants to marginalize Manuel Zelaya and keep him out of power in Honduras?
Yeah, again, that's the million-dollar question. I've had this conversation with several friends, colleagues, scholars who, you know, are all very well informed on this, and we have, you know, people are divided on this. Some see signs that the Obama administration is kind of, you know, happy in some senses that the Zelaya was ousted from office, and it's a kind of a shot across the bow to Hugo Chavez and the other leftist kinds of regimes in Latin America. And others are like, no, this isn't really doesn't make any sense. What does the U.S. gain by this? The reality is that this, whatever the administration is thinking, the reality is that this is a very dangerous situation for Central America, for Latin America, because it sets a huge precedent in terms of the possibility of regional destabilization and a huge step backwards in terms of the democratization that has just recently begun to be consolidated in the past 20 years. So, very serious, very worrisome, possibly destabilizing for the entire region.
Maybe you could step back just a moment and talk about Manuel Zelaya's effort to have a non-binding referendum among Honduran citizens to see whether rewriting the Honduran Constitution would be something that should happen in the future. And one of the things that was floated but was not part of this referendum that never happened because of the coup was to extend the presidential term beyond one term in office. And this is a wider issue around Latin America that we can talk about in a moment. But in your reading of this, what was the reaction, or I should rather say it like this, was the reaction of Congress and the Supreme Court justified, maybe not in exiling Manuel Zelaya at gunpoint, but in terms of trying to stop this referendum that they claim was unconstitutional?
Yeah, from my understanding of this, there was no mention of re-election in the referendum. It was the possibility. You got to remember that the Honduran Constitution, which was enacted in 1982, just recently, if they had even come out of the military dictatorship at that point in time, they had just come out of the military dictatorship. And so military kind of influences and conservative influences, extreme right wing, the kind of death squad style dictatorships that Honduras was known for as well, and Central America was known for, these kinds of individuals were the ones writing this this constitution that Zelaya was talking about, having citizens get an input in kind of trying to rewrite or to kind of have some form of democratic participation in its say. So this is what they were trying to look at rewriting. From my understanding of it was that it was not going to be about the kind of a second term. In fact, Zelaya's term was the elections were coming up in November, and so he would have been out of office in January by the time this referendum, the referendum he wanted to hold, by the time it was held in November, or by the time it was held, he would have been out of office. There would have been elections already. So I think this is kind of a wild goose chase, or a kind of distraction, a diversionary tactic by the coup plotters to kind of say, look, they're being undemocratic, right? Raising the standard of being of Zelaya being anti-democratic in order to gain favor amongst an international audience. So, I mean, I think it's a very cynical attempt at doing so and claiming the mantle of democracy for themselves when they're, in fact, the ones undermining a democratic process, right? What can be more democratic than asking the populace, do you think we should, you know, have a kind of an amendment to a constitution, right? And this was not even as you mentioned, not even a binding resolution. This was almost a poll that was going on. So it is a very cynical manipulation by the coup plotters.
Hector Perla is our guest, Assistant Professor of Latin American Studies and Latino Studies at the University of California at Santa Cruz. Professor Perla, there have been some stories that talk about covert involvement by a former Bush administration official in this coup d'etat. His name is Otto Reich, and he's a former advisor to President Bush on Latin American affairs. What have you heard, if anything, about Mr. Reich and his advice, or in any way, shape, or form involvement here?
Well, I've heard similar kinds of things as what you just mentioned. Nothing more deep or more particular than that. But just kind of remembering Otto Reich's trajectory as well. He was very heavily involved in Honduras when Honduras was the hub of the Contra resupply, the Iran around the whole Iran-Contra scandal time period in the 1980s. He was in Honduras at that time, and so he's very familiar. He knows the region, and he was involved at the time when there were some illegal activities going on. So I can't speak to the kinds of things that he was involved in doing now, but you know, his trajectory, his past, and his kind of extreme right-wing ideological bent leaves one, you know, wondering how deeply involved he was involved in this, right? In at least the sense that maybe providing logistical or kind of connections to Washington, and that's something that we have seen. One of the things that I was just received information about was that when in the first meeting between Micheletti and Arias, Micheletti brought with him several Washington, D.C. lobbyists, people, lawyers who had been involved with the Clinton administration, in fact. So it's interesting to see that there is some Washington involvement here. It hasn't been really picked up by any of the mainstream media. But there is some sense that it makes you wonder how deeply involved Washington insiders are in this thing.
Well, I wanted to address that very point. There have been press reports, as you said, that Lonnie Davis, a very well-known advisor to the former Clinton administration, as well as another guy named Clifton, I'm trying to remember
Bennett?
His name.
Was
yeah,
Bennett?
Bennett Radcliffe is the other one. Now, these two individuals, advisors to the Clinton administration, had accompanied the de facto president installed by the coup makers in Honduras. They accompanied
Micheletti.
Yeah, Micheletti, who's right. the de facto president. What can you tell us about these former Clinton officials and how they exactly relate to this unconstitutionally installed president?
Well, I think what's happening here is that the Honduran de facto government has been completely isolated, both at the level of the United Nations and at the level of multilateral organizations like the Organization of American States, the OAS, unanimously condemned around the world. And so no one has recognized this de facto government, and so they're going out and they're needing to get these kinds of lobbyists and hire these lobbyists and use them as brokers with people who are very influential in Washington. And I think that's what we're seeing is a very effective, who do you turn to when you can't get access to Hillary Clinton, someone who was President Clinton's a lawyer involved in President Clinton's administration, and using those kind of back channels to get some pressure and hopefully get, at least this is what the Honduran de facto government is thinking, get inside track with Washington and the Obama administration. So I think that's really what's happening here. On the other hand, you also have several Republican Congress people, senators, including, I believe, John McCain, has been kind of going around and trying to open the door for some of these for the Micheletti administration and trying to get build some kind of backdoor channeling and influence to get people to recognize, or the administration, to recognize this de facto government. So far, it hasn't worked. But as I said, there is not as strong a stance by the Obama administration as is possible and as should be to use the influence that the U.S. has and the prestige of the United States to really get these guys to do the right thing and follow international law and restore the constitutional order in Honduras.
We're speaking with Hector Perla, Assistant Professor of Latin American and Latino Studies at the University of California at Santa Cruz. My name is Scott Harris, and the program is Counterpoint. We're talking about the coup in Honduras and the aftermath here. Hector, I wanted to ask you about the Obama administration addressing the very poisonous legacy of U.S. imperialism as practiced in Latin America, certainly since the Monroe Doctrine in 1823 and well before and after. The United States has a history of intervention either directly through U.S. troops or fomenting civil wars or having organized insurrections or coups in countless countries across Latin America over all those years. And is President Obama, in your view, trying to move away from that history in terms of how he's relating to Latin American nations?
Well, he's definitely an improvement from the Bush administration in terms of relations with Latin America. That there's no doubt about that. There's definitely an improved relationship with the Obama administration. But that's not saying very much. That's not saying very much. The relationship with the Bush administration was completely strained. And so it's still early in the Obama administration, and there's been, I would say, mixed messages. There's some good signs, and there's also some bad signs. In some ways, you see the Obama administration moving forward, shaking hands with different leaders around the world, engaging in dialogue, listening to the kinds of the complaints of the region, not coming in with a necessarily with a bullying attitude or an ideological attitude, as heavily as the Bush administration. On the other hand, there is still a very strong, inertia that's left over from that legacy that the Obama administration has just not been able to break. And I think that this is an example. The Honduran situation is a clear example of that, where a clear break with the past would have been to take a leadership position among, in the hemisphere with all the other countries of the region, and really go on and use the prestige and the weight of the United States to get the de facto government, the coup, to basically allow the president back in. And there's precedent for that. There is precedent for that. I don't know if you remember, your listeners might remember, in the 1990s, mid to early 1990s, in Haiti there was a coup against the president at the time, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, and the Clinton administration, in essence, eventually issued an ultimatum and got the military to withdraw and allow Aristide to be reinstated. And so there's this precedent, and there is this foot dragging that there's no other way I can think of to describe it, by the Obama administration, and they have a unanimous consensus, not just by the countries of the Western Hemisphere, but from the United Nations, a mandate to act, and we haven't seen that leadership that would really signal a clear break from that, the tragic history of the past imperialism in Latin America, U.S. imperialism in Latin America. Unfortunate.
And I guess we're running out of time, unfortunately, Hector Perlow, but I wanted to ask you this. There has certainly been, you know, what some describe as the pink tide, the progressive and socialist governments that have come to power across Latin America. And often you get analysts talking about two competing poles of this movement. You have Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez on one side, sort of more doctrinaire socialism. And then you have Brazilian President Ignacio Lula da Silva on the other side, which is characterized as a more pragmatic, progressive public policy there in that country. Where do you see things headed in Latin America? And certainly debunk that analysis if you don't think it's correct.
Absolutely. No, thank you for actually touching on this, because this is one of the things that I think is most damaging to our understanding and our policy towards Latin America. This whole myth of the good left, bad left, to me is just a completely a false dichotomy. I think what you have in Latin America is a general trend by pretty much all the countries of the Western Hemisphere, and you can even include the United States in this trend, right, in kind of moving from a in the 1990s and in the 2000s, moving away from a right-wing, completely neoliberal, free market capitalism to a kind of a recognition that that the government needs to do more to regulate, to ensure that there is not these huge income inequalities that were generated in the past 10, 20 years under neoliberal economics policies. And so there's a recognition across the globe and across the Western Hemisphere, excuse me. And the United States is also part of that trend. And so I don't think it's correct to talk about a good left, bad left. I think what's really happening and what we can really talk about is a kind of a sense of frustration with the ways in which the promises of both neoliberal capitalism, free market capitalism, have created more inequality. The poverty has not abated, and the kind of small government has led to very inefficient kinds of policies, very unjust distributions of income. And really, what people are clamoring for is a government that does more in terms of addressing the basic needs of the people of the hemisphere. And I think this is, as I said, is not just in Latin America. This is something that is a trend in the United States as well. So that's how I would, address that particular question.
All right. Well, I guess I wanted to sort of do a crystal ball question here at the end.
Sure.
Do you think in the end, after future negotiations, we're going to see the return of Manuel Zelaya to power in Honduras? Are you optimistic that's going to happen?
This is, again, an incredibly important question. The precedent that it would set if he does not return is incredible. It would for the entire hemisphere, in Latin America in particular, would mean a regression of 50 years at least in terms of political democracy. And many, as I said, you know, waves of destabilization are possible. So I hope, I'm trying to be optimistic about it, but I would, you know, I would be cautiously optimistic. But there is a sense in Honduras, you know, from all the reports I keep getting from different colleagues and organizations that are working down there, their people are still in the streets, people are still active, and they haven't given up. And it looks like there is a consensus at the international level that also people are not giving up, people are not recognizing the illegitimate government. So I am cautiously optimistic. But it's also important and incumbent upon us here in the United States as U.S. citizens to also get our government to be responsible. And so one of the things that I would like to leave your listeners with is asking them to write to their congressperson, write to Hillary Clinton, write to President Obama, write op-ed pieces, write letters to the editors if you can, explaining your position about this, because this is the only way we're going to get our government to do the right thing on this. And hopefully things will return to normalcy, democracy, and constitutional rule of law in Honduras and in Latin America.
Well said, Professor Perla. Thank you very much for being here with us tonight, and I hope we can call upon you again to talk about this and other related topics. So,
thank you, Scott. It was a pleasure.
Hector, is there any web addresses you want to leave our listeners for good ways to get information on what's going on across Latin America?
Yeah, let me think of English language. Let me see. What is a good one? Let me pull one up for you.
In the meantime, I can just say that NACLA Reports is always a good place.
Absolutely, absolutely.
North American Congress on Latin America, NACLA, I believe NACLA.org is one place, right?
Yes, there's NACLA. You can look at the Latin America Working Group. There, you can Google them. I don't have their on hand. You can also look at the Washington Office on Latin America.
Right. Larry Burns' group. We've had Larry on a lot.
That's right. We'll the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. I was looking for one that was directly from Latin America for you, but I'm not finding it on my...
We'll have you back again. We'll talk more about it. You can email it to me. I can always certainly announce it next week, if not this week. So.
Oh, Common Dreams is another good one.
Of course. CommonDreams.org is a good place. So.
Okay. So thank you once again.
Thank you very much, Hector. We'll talk again soon.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye. This is WPKN in Bridgeport at 89.5 FM and WPKM in Montauk, New York at 88.7 FM. The program is Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris. We're going to continue in just a couple of moments with a discussion of nuclear weapons and negotiations between the United States and Russia. Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment.
Copa larga. su larga copa larga, luna temprana por sobre el mar.
Scott Harris, and the program is Counterpoint here on WPKN in Bridgeport, WPKM in Montauk. And right now I'd like to introduce to you John Isaacs. He's Executive Director and President of the Council for a Livable World and Executive Director of the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. He serves as a contributing editor to the excellent publication Bulletin of the Atomic Scientist. John Isaacs, thanks for being here with us tonight.
Sure, glad to do so.
So we had you here tonight to talk about President Barack Obama's talks with Russian President Dmitry Medvedev in Moscow. A joint understanding was reported that signed between the two men that the United States and Russia would work towards cutting deployed nuclear warheads to as few as 1,500 each, and a later goal would be to reduce the total warheads, as I understand it, from to 1,675 within the next 7 years. I'm sure I got a little piece of that mixed up, but maybe you could sort of explain in layman's terms exactly what the U.S. and Russian presidents agreed to last week.
Sure, I'll be glad to do so. Just a bit of background. We're coming off an eight-year period where the United States and Russia were at loggerheads on many issues. We know President Bush said he saw into the soul of Russian President Vladimir Putin, and the two sides had disagreements on many issues. So one thing Barack Obama promised to do is try to rebuild relations with Russia. It's better to be talking with him than squabbling with him. The two leaders met briefly at a summit at a meeting in April, and then more thoroughly last week, and had a longer conversation. The most significant achievement was an agreement to proceed with further nuclear weapons reduction. Now, despite the end of the Cold War, both Russia and the United States each has deployed more than 2,000 nuclear warheads and many more nuclear warheads in storage or ready that could be used in a short while. Each one of these nuclear weapons,
each bomb we have is, almost every one of them is larger than those that destroyed two Japanese cities at the end of World War II, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So again, over 2,000 deployed nuclear weapons, much larger than those that destroyed two Japanese cities. The two countries agreed at the summit meeting last week that they would complete an agreement by December of this year, December 2009. That date is important because the previous major arms control agreement, so-called START, or Strategic Arms Reduction Talks, was an agreement concluded in 1991, expires in December. And that agreement, besides setting various limits on both nuclear weapons, as well as the missiles and the launchers that would send those nuclear warheads at each other, also that treaty had a lot of verification procedures, so each side knew what the other was doing. That treaty, all those verification procedures would expire in December if there's no new agreement. But Presidents Obama and Medvedev, you pronounce it better than I do, agreed that they would conclude another agreement by December in which they'd make reductions perhaps to maybe 1,500, 1,675 deployed nuclear warheads, strategic warheads. And that's a good reduction of nuclear weapons. Remember that the two countries, the United States and Russia, between them have about 95% of the world's nuclear weapons. I would argue that even 1,500 nuclear weapons is much too large, and we can go for further reductions later on, and the two countries have said they'll do so. But this is an excellent start, and it's good that the two countries are talking to each other again as well as just squabbling.
John Isaacs, as I understand it, there are a lot of conservative politicians in this country that are opposed to linking U.S. missile defense programs to any agreement to reduce offensive weapons. And I wonder if you would talk about the Obama administration's attitude towards a project begun under President Bush, which was the deployment of an anti-missile system, a radar, and missile launchers in Eastern Europe, specifically in Poland and the Czech Republic, that has been very controversial in Russia. And has Obama stepped back from that in any way, shape, or form in these negotiations?
I think the best way to talk about it is to say that the Obama administration has really kicked the issue down the road. First of all, the United States is in the middle of a review, both of nuclear weapons as well as anti-missile systems. And that review probably will not be concluded till about December. At the same time, we face this deadline for an agreement for the Strategic Arms Limitation Agreement of December 2009. So there's no way really that the United States will make a final decision on deploying interceptor missiles in Poland and the Czech Republic. And I think the Russians are very unhappy with the U.S. deployment. But one of the factors is that even under the best of circumstances, it'll be another 2-3 years before the United States could actually deploy some missiles in Poland and the Czech Republic. We haven't even built the missiles that will be deployed there, much less tested them. Now, President George W. Bush promised Poland and the Czech Republic that we would deploy those interceptor missiles there, despite Russian feelings. But I would say right now the issue is on hold. I don't know if you'd say Obama's step back from it, but he's really postponed a decision until later. There's a question whether the missile will work, whether it'll be cost-effective, and whether it's worth all the trouble. Those decisions, I think, can be put down the road, and I think the Russians will accept that the missile defense issue will have to be worked out, but not as this first round of negotiations on cutting nuclear weapons.
In your view, what was the Bush administration's goal in deploying this missile system in the years ahead in Eastern Europe? On its face, it was talked about being a deterrent to rogue states like Iran, who, if they developed payload capacity or developed nuclear weapons that could be carried by long-range missiles, that somehow that this anti-missile system would blunt that. But the Russians, of course, believed that this was really a way to more confront them and their nuclear weapons power, and thereby creating a lot of distrust and upset in Russia. What do you think the real goal here was?
I think there are two primary goals of the George W. Bush administration. First of all, the Bush administration was administration was really a strong believer in missile defense. One of the first things the new administration did shortly after the 9/11 attacks on New York and Washington, D.C., was to tear up, announcing the United States was withdrawing from a treaty negotiated back in 1972 to put some limits on anti-ballistic missiles. And the administration did so after 6 months, withdrew from the treaty and said, we're going to go ahead and deploy all sorts of missile defenses. And in fact, the United States did deploy national missile defense, longer-range interceptors, in California and in Alaska, in theory to defend against a North Korean attack. So the administration is a believer in that administration is a believer in missile defense, despite serious questions whether the system would ever work. And so, again, part of the decision, I think, from the Bush administration to put the systems in Poland and Czech Republic was an extension of that view. We want to deploy any kind of missile defense systems wherever we can, and we can do so in Poland and Czech Republic. I think the other major factor was, let's stick it to the Russians. The U.S. and the Russians had many disagreements in past years over the conflict in Georgia, over NATO expansion, over Russian attitudes towards Iranian nuclear programs. And one of the things the Bush administration wanted to do was say, okay, well, this is something that will really irritate the Russians. Deploying 10 or a few more interceptor missiles in Poland and Czech Republic wasn't really going to affect the Russian nuclear deterrent, but it did affect the Russian attitudes and prestige because they felt, okay, the Warsaw Pact has broken away. Poland and Czech Republic were no longer Soviet satellites. But on the other hand, we objected the United States to opening military bases and putting interceptor missiles. So I think those are the two primary reasons that the Bush administration went ahead. And I think the administration, Bush administration tried to get the decision completed and some interceptor missiles actually deployed before the Bush administration left office, but they weren't able to do so.
John Isaacs, it seems that despite the dissolution of the Soviet Union and the ostensible end of the Cold War, it seems like we're still living out the Cold War, that in terms of U.S. policy towards Russia and this, thousands of nuclear missiles on a hair trigger alert, that we really haven't put the Cold War behind us. Why is that?
I think you're correct, and I think there are a couple different factors involved. First of all, I thought there was an opportunity to develop a closer relationship with Russia once the Soviet Union dissolved. Now, Russia, after the Soviet Union dissolved, was in a pretty bad place economically, politically, internationally, and I think that was a good time to try to bring Russia into the fold of nations working cooperatively internationally, the way we've done with Poland, the Czech Republic, Hungary, Latvia, Lithuania, and other states. I know it would have been more difficult with Russia, but having Russia inside the tent rather than outside of the tent might have avoided some problems. The Clinton administration is as much to blame as the Bush administration, quite frankly. The Clinton administration was very slow to build these ties with Russians, and the Russians felt, in fact, that Americans were showing superiority and saying, you Russians don't count for anything anymore, we're not going to pay much attention to you, and that was a mistake. But in terms of nuclear weapons, in fact, there have been substantial reductions in nuclear weapons since the height of the Cold War. But as you point out, we still have many thousands of nuclear warheads, Russians and the United States. And I think it's just countries are very slow to change policies. I know we're almost 20 years after the end of the Cold War, almost 20 years after the dissolution of the Soviet Union, yet we still have thousands of nuclear warheads. And again, that's a legacy of the Cold War, and countries take a long time to change policies. I think the Clinton administration could have reduced nuclear weapons more, but they had other priorities, mainly economic problems that they wanted to focus on. If you recall, the slogan of the Clinton administration was, it's economy stupid. And the Bush administration came in 2001 and really liked nuclear weapons and sought additional roles for nuclear weapons. So it wasn't interested in too much of a drastic change from the end of the Cold War. It just when circumstances change, countries, corporations, and even individuals are sometimes very slow to react and make the changes that would be commensurate with the changes that are in the circumstance around them.
But you mentioned corporations. How much influence does the military-industrial complex, as President Eisenhower coined the term, how much influence do they have on continuing our nuclear armaments and the whole industry behind it, where certainly there's a lot of profit to be made?
Actually, I would disagree with you on this. I think the corporations are very influential in conventional weapons programs. Even today, the United States Senate was debating an amendment from Chairman Carl Levin of Michigan and Senator McCain of Arizona to eliminate $1.7 billion in funds added for the F-22 aircraft. And here you have a situation in the F-22 where the members of Congress from the states where this F-22 is produced, the unions are involved, the corporations are involved, lobbying heavily to make sure the extra $1.7 billion beyond what Secretary of Defense Gates wants was put into the authorization bill. But on nuclear weapons, the corporations aren't really profiting. It's in terms of both arms control treaties, arms control reductions, or building nuclear weapons, that's really a government process. It's the Department of Energy that makes the nuclear weapons, destroys the nuclear weapons, and it's the military that controls them, but it's not. There are no great corporate riches. So in terms of nuclear weapons issues, we really don't face opposition from major corporations, Lockheed Martin or Boeing or any of the others. It's a very different situation than conventional weapons programs.
In talking about President Obama's nuclear posture review, I wondered if you'd address some of the tenets of the previous Bush administration where they didn't reject a U.S. nuclear first strike. The Bush administration advocated building a new generation of nuclear warheads and tactical nuclear weapons, which sent a lot of fear around the world that the U.S. Under Bush was planning to use nuclear weapons in a battlefield somewhere. What kind of changes do you think that President Obama will make from the Bush administration's
sure.
nuclear policies?
I think I would argue, and I think the Obama administration is going to go in the same direction, that nuclear weapons serve only one purpose, and that's to deter a nuclear weapons attack on us. And if you believe that, if nuclear weapons are really suicide weapons, both would destroy other societies and destroy our own society, then the argument for having thousands of nuclear weapons, or even more than a few hundred, really fades away. The Bush administration came in and issued a series of policy statements in which they looked for new uses of nuclear weapons, possible uses in the conflict in the Taiwan Straits with China, possible use of nuclear weapons in the conflict in the Middle East or with Syria. In other words, to us, and I think what the Obama administration is going to come up with, is that nuclear weapons really have only that one use, and to try to find other uses and build new nuclear weapons and build smaller nuclear weapons and more lethal nuclear weapons, all that's going to be thrown overboard. I think, unfortunately, there will be some modernization of our existing nuclear weapons, even as we're producing, but that may be the political price the Obama administration has to pay to conclude a new nuclear reductions treaty with Russia. And even more importantly, next year, we hope to get ratification of the treaty to end all nuclear explosive testing, the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. I mean, that's my guess. We won't know for sure where the Obama administration will be coming down, and we won't know what numbers the administration is proposing for our nuclear weapons stockpile until the end of the year.
We're speaking tonight on Counterpoint with John Isaacs, Executive Director and President of the Council for a Livable World and Executive Director of the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. John Isaacs, I wanted to ask you about Obama's stated goal of eliminating nuclear weapons. How realistic a goal is that in the foreseeable future if President Obama is elected to a second term over the next 8 years? And what lessons can we learn from a similar statement that was surprisingly reached by Russian President Gorbachev and Ronald Reagan in the Reykjavik, Iceland nuclear talks back in 1986 that failed to produce the ostensible elimination of nuclear weapons? But what can we learn from that?
I think you cite both President Reagan and President Gorbachev back in the 80s, and then more recently you can cite an awful lot of major public officials who have been involved in nuclear weapons who are arguing that nuclear weapons today are as more of a danger than they are a system for protecting security. That the more nuclear weapons there are in the world, the more likely terrorists, for example, are going to get their hands on one and maybe explode a nuclear weapon in some city. I mean, we've been very fortunate since 1945, since the United States used two nuclear bombs in Japan. We've been very fortunate that although the U.S. and Russia built thousands of nuclear weapons, neither country used them against the other, although it came awfully darn close during the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. And we've been lucky that while there are other countries that developed them, nuclear weapons, including China, including France, including Great Britain, Israel, India, Pakistan, and now North Korea, despite that, no country has used nuclear weapons against another country. But we're getting the argument, as you cite, both Gorbachev and Reagan, but now more recently by former Secretaries of State Henry Kissinger, former Secretary of State George Shultz, both who served Republicans, former Georgia Senator Sam Nunn, who served as chairman of the Armed Services Committee, former Defense Secretary under Democrats William Perry, and a lot of other distinguished, in fact, nuclear hawks who say nuclear weapons may have had a role at one point, but now they're more of a danger than they are more than for our security, and it's possible to consider first dramatic reductions in our nuclear weapons and eventually getting to zero. Now, when President Obama endorsed this world of free of nuclear weapons in a major speech in April in Prague, Czech Republic, he said, it may not happen in my lifetime, and it's clearly a goal that's not going to take a number of years. And the first, just this first modest agreement between the U.S. and Russia is taking close to a year, 6 months to a year to negotiate. Eventually, we're going to have to bring in those other nuclear powers, China, that I mentioned, China, France, Great Britain, India, Pakistan, Israel, North Korea, into negotiations. And it's not going to be easy. I mean, it's tough enough to negotiate with two countries, much less negotiate with nine countries or more on getting rid of nuclear weapons. Moreover, we're going to have much better verification system. And clearly, the system is pretty good now for determining whether the Russians or the Americans are cheating on the arms control agreements. But when you're talking about going from thousands of nuclear weapons to 200 or 100 or 50 or 25, then the possible importance of cheating becomes more important, and the technology is going to have to be improved to ensure that no country could secretly either retain a nuclear weapon or develop a nuclear weapon. So I think it's an achievable goal. It's not going to be very near-term, and not during the 8 years of Barack Obama assuming president for two terms, but it is a goal to be sought after, and there are many steps on the way to zero nuclear weapons that would be very productive for U.S. and Russian and the world security that we'd like to see accomplished as we move towards zero nuclear weapons.
John Isaacs, you mentioned, of course, the proliferation of nuclear weapons and the problems therein. We have North Korea recently tested nuclear weapons. The concern that Iran is in the process of developing weapons. India and Pakistan both having nuclear weapons. And the widespread belief, and I think widely confirmed, that Israel has nuclear weapons. Do you believe that the approach to non-proliferation should be through...
You know how to say.
Right, well, you know how to say. This is your stock and trade. But in terms of approaching the need for non-proliferation, is it better to address that through global agreements or regional agreements in terms of the Middle East or Asia addressing, you know, the spread of nuclear weapons to these new nations?
Well, I guess I'd argue both. One of the most important treaties of the nuclear age was the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty signed by President Lyndon Johnson in 1960. And I think some 180, 190 countries have signed that agreement, which there is a basic bargain. The nuclear powers at that point, the United States, Soviet Union, Great Britain, France, and China, would agree to stop nuclear weapons testing and eventually move to zero nuclear weapons. And other countries would agree as part of the bargain that while they could build nuclear power plants, domestic nuclear power plants, they would not build nuclear weapons. And that bargain has largely succeeded. There's a conference an international conference in May 2010, which will review the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and we're hoping it might strengthen the treaty. But the issue is also regional, as you suggest. I mean, our real fear about North Korea is North Korea keeps building nuclear weapons, and in reaction, Japan builds nuclear weapons. South Korea builds nuclear weapons. Taiwan builds nuclear weapons. In other words, there might be a regional arms race. And similarly, in the Middle East, if Iran builds nuclear weapons, the Egyptians may follow suit. The Saudi Arabians might follow suit. And so you have even more dangerous situations around the globe. So we have to deal with situations both regionally and globally. Most importantly, there will be a global negotiation. In May 2010, the Nuclear Nonproliferation Review Conference is one of the key times where the entire world can come together to address the proliferation challenges in the world.
Well, we're just about out of time, John Isaacs. Thank you so much for being here tonight to talk about some of these deeper issues that relate to President Obama's discussions and agreement with the Russian president last week. And leave our listeners, if you would, with some websites, including the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, where our listeners can get various perspectives on nuclear arsenal issues.
Well, the Council for Livable Worlds website is www.livableworld.org, LIVABLE.org, www.livableworld.org. We've been around since 1962 working on these issues and are very optimistic about progress during the Obama administration. We also have a Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, another arm of the work, the educational work, and that's www.armscontrolcenter.org, www.armscontrolcenter.org. Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, I'm not sure. It's probably www. You can always Google Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. I'm afraid I don't know that offhand. My brain doesn't hold too much information next time.
No, I'm sure it'll be easy to find. But I thank you so much for being here, John Isaacs, and appreciate, and I know many of our listeners are fans of your work to stop this crazy nuclear arms race that continues, despite I think the consciousness of the world that, and an acknowledgement that it should have stopped a long time ago. But
right.
Thank you for all your work.
I'm delighted to do it, delighted to be on the program, and anytime you want to discuss these issues when they hit the news again, I'll be glad to do so.
Much appreciated. Thanks,
sure.
John.
Good night.
Good night. John Isaacs, again, Executive Director and President of the Council for a Livable World and Executive Director of the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. And I'll take you out with a little bit of music from Mr. David Rovick, something called Hiroshima. And we're going to be back with a discussion of the U.S. housing market, suburban sprawl, and rethinking U.S. home ownership and how we build houses in this country with a guest who just wrote a book titled The Cul-de-sac Syndrome, Turning Around the Unsustainable American Dream. We'll be speaking with John Wasik in just a few minutes, so stay tuned here on WPKN in Bridgeport and WPKN in Montauk. Our website, by the way, is WPKN.org, and you can go there to get our program schedule and make online contributions to this listener-supported station, and also reminding you that this show, Counterpoint, is now archived after some repair work on the website WhiteRoseSociety.org. We had some problems there for a while, some months, but now it's back up. It's WhiteRoseSociety.org, and every Counterpoint program heard on Monday nights has got an audio archive of that show there. And some of the interviews that you hear on this program are also edited down in shorter form and placed in our program, Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, Between the Lines, which is heard on this station three times a week, and around the country on various 50 stations around the U.S. That website, you can go to hear the program anytime and go to our audio archives there. It's btlonline.org, btlonline.org. And you can subscribe there for weekly interview transcripts, program summaries, and podcasts. That's btlonline.org. We'll be back in just a couple of moments. This is David Rovick's.
And children played in the playground, swinging on swings, didn't hear the sound of the single plane that flew overhead. third shift workers were just going to bed. There was a flash of light and a rumbling noise, gone in an instant. Parents, girls, and boys, 10,000 mothers were boiling rice. Thousand prisoners of war were rolling their dice, hoping they'd survive this terrible storm. When each young man in his uniform vanished in the air in the blink of an eye. One moment they lived, on the next they all died. Hiroshima. Hiroshima. Ten thousand chickens were sitting on eggs. Beaks in their wings, rest in their legs.
This is Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris, and right now I'd like to welcome to the program John F. Wasik. He's an award-winning personal finance columnist with Bloomberg News and the author of 12 books, including The Merchant of Power, which was praised by Pulitzer Prize-winning author Studs Terkel, among others. And John Wasik's newest book that he's here on our program tonight to talk about is titled The Cul-de-Sac Syndrome, Turning Around the Unsustainable American Dream. Thanks so much for being here tonight, John.
My pleasure, Scott.
So I think a good place to start is where you start in the book. You're talking about the sort of tracing the history of home ownership in this country. It's been a primary element of the American dream, and as you point out in the book, Thomas Jefferson talked about it, and it got a big push after World War II with the GI Bill. But it's been a feature of, or I guess a signpost of American success, owning a home. You want to just say a word about the importance of home ownership in our culture and society?
Well, it's clearly part of our cultural DNA. We have come to this country largely as immigrants, and we really wanted a piece of land. We really wanted to build a castle on it. And for more than 400 years, that's been the objective, to come to this continent, at least for Europeans. And we have this idea that this is part of our entitlement. This is part of the birthright of being an American. You need to get that house. You need to get that piece of sod and make something of it. And this has been embedded in our birthright for a long time.
And, of course, we've just gone through this and are still going through the subprime mortgage housing crisis and ensuing crash in the U.S. real estate market. And it's resulted in millions of foreclosures and bankruptcies of families across the country. And owning a home, even before that happened, as you talk about in the book, has become increasingly unaffordable, which led many to take these dangerous risks with the adjustable rate mortgages. In other words, it seemed such a priority for families that these risks were taken, and maybe in better times they would have survived. But, of course, people have gone down in flames here, millions of them across the country. Take a look at those risks and wonder what's pushed people to put so much of their family's fortune there at the casino table, which is really, I guess, what happened. A lot of people lost that game.
Well, we've had a lot of examination of Wall Street, securitization of mortgages, greed, speculation, the Greenspan 11 interest rate cuts. All that has been really thoroughly discussed. What really has been ignored is the fact that we have needed to have a home ownership policy in the country. It's been a stated policy for as long as I can remember, put as many people in a home as possible to stabilize communities, to give people a piece of the pie. And that went on steroids during the whole housing bubble. We wanted to get those people in at any cost, and what happened was that many people got in, probably shouldn't have. We lost sight of a lot of things in doing so, and now we really have to reevaluate where we're at. Do we really want home ownership to be 70%, 80%, or perhaps we should be looking at affordable housing, affordable rents in every area?
Now, you write about in the book the kind of interesting angle, you know, hadn't been obvious to me, and I'm sure many listeners and readers of the book, that property tax revenue here in this country funds schools and other municipal services. And that fact leads many cities across the country to favor more expensive housing construction and thereby decreasing the stock of homes available for working and middle-class families. In other words, you know, if you could zone a parcel of property for a McMansion rather than affordable housing, you're going to do it because the city gets more money per acre. You want to explain that dynamic and how that's affected sort of where housing has gone in recent years?
Well, this is an elusive concept to a lot of people. The whole reason that the suburbs really took off was that people moved out of the cities. They wanted a better school district. They wanted more land. They wanted more house for their money. And in the process, suburbs said, well, you know, they're coming here for better schools, and we better build some bigger houses on bigger lots so we can get a bigger chunk of tax revenue for these school districts if we're to really claim that we're, you know, fulfilling the American dream. Unfortunately, that's a connection that's been severed. Lately, home values have dropped. People have been appealing their value.
I'm wondering what happened to John. We're going to have to, the phone line just dropped out. Let me put on a public service announcement, and we'll try and get that on here. Oh, I've got an announcement we can put on right now. We'll get John back on the phone to finish the interview here. Just something about a very interesting arts benefit that's coming to WPKN in just, I think, shortly. So I'm not sure of the date, but you'll hear it right now, and we'll be back with John Wasik in just a moment.
This is One More Toke, the words and music of Brewer and Shipley on listener-supported WPKN.
One toke over the line, sweet Jesus, one toke over the line. Sitting downtown in a railway station, one toke over the line. Waiting for the train that goes home, sweet Mary, hoping that the train is on time. Sitting downtown in a railway station, one toke.
I'm Kevin Gallagher, and this is WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and I'm on the phone with Mike Brewer and Tom Shipley of Brewer and Shipley. You had really well-crafted songs. You had incredible production, in my opinion, but the one thing that stands out the most is your guys' vocals.
The light within me shineth, the light within me flows, I'll sing a song of the kingdom, and hope the spirit grows.
I'm not sure what that was, but it was mislabeled. I thought we were talking about an art benefit. Anyway, apologies for the technical glitch that took John Wasik away from us. Again, we're talking about his book, The Cul-de-Sac Syndrome, Turning Around the Unsustainable American Dream. And John, glad you're back here, but let's pick off where you left off.
Property taxes,
that's
a great subject, because there's this link between the amount of revenue that goes into schools and public services and the value of homes. So most communities, if they're fairly new or established, want to have those bigger homes in there. Unfortunately, that crowds out other people who are looking for affordable housing, and it's really unsustainable because you can only build so many McMansions. And over time, there's only so many people who can afford them. And during the boom, just millions crowded into them because leverage was cheap. They got to write off their property taxes, their mortgage interest, got a break on capital gains. So the whole thing was effectively subsidized. And in far-out suburbs, which I call spurbs or sprawling urban areas, What happened was that the federal budget subsidized the building of highways and built places that were not connected to anywhere. And people who thought they were getting a big bargain on a McMansion on a big lot soon found out that taxes had to rise to build the new schools, to build the libraries, the fire stations, the roads, the water mains, everything that had to catch up with them because there was no infrastructure. So the bargain that people thought they were getting by moving, you know, 60, 90 miles out from a major city turned out to be a raw deal after time.
Now, you advocate the idea of delinking property taxes from funding municipal services like education, which is the societal function primarily financed by property taxes.
Well, here's the devil's connection. Nobody has really lived through a time in which property valuations have dropped significantly. This is a test for every taxing body all over the country, particularly on the coast, where they have dropped 40-50% in many places, and foreclosures will continue to put downward pressure on valuations. So what do you do in that case if your property taxes are almost the exclusive source of revenue for your schools and other public services? You have to look to some other sources. We have to, you know, recognize this fact and say, look, why don't we spread it out a little bit more between state income tax, excise taxes, sin taxes, and anything else? But it shouldn't be exclusively relying on property taxes. This is a particular problem in the Northeast and Midwest and places where almost all the revenue has to come from property taxes.
So, John, when you envision sort of a future, a way apart from this model of single-family home ownership, and we'll get to the sort of environmental implications of suburban sprawl that you talk about in the book in a moment, but when you look at a different model for how we house ourselves in the cities or in the suburbs, lay that idea out for us. What do you think we need to reinvent here in terms of housing?
Well, we need to take another look at the old-fashioned town. You look at any town in New England, and you'll see a town center with a church, a little commercial district, the library, the Masons Hall. Everything that had to do with civic activities was in a couple of square blocks. We can do that again on a larger scale, make more walkable, pedestrian-friendly, bike-friendly communities, and reduce the amount of traffic that's needed to get to essential amenities. This is called the movement's called New Urbanism, and it's really a good idea. You can have higher density in terms of neighborhoods. They're much more walkable, much more human scale. It's happening all over the country. But we need to have enlightened building codes, zoning codes, in a way of saying, look, we can do this much more intelligently, much more comprehensively, and get people out of their cars and seeing their neighbors again.
How much is that happening around the country? I mean, maybe you could give us some examples you talk about in the book in terms of cities that are doing exactly that, rezoning, recalibrating downtown areas or neighborhoods, trying to get a mix of commercial and residential, a higher density so there'd be more energy efficiency. Of course, mass transit is a huge key in all this because if people feel they have to own a car to drive everywhere, you know, we are anchored to our cars in such a way that is going to exacerbate all the things that we connect with cars and pollution and global warming and the rest of it.
Well, it's happening in just about every metropolitan area, particularly in areas that have some room to grow. You see it in the Kentlands in Maryland, suburban Washington. One of the things that I profiled was a place called Celebration, which is in Florida near Disney World. And these new urbanist communities say, we have a philosophy behind us. We want people to have porches. We want to be able to walk to a little downtown where we don't have to drive out to the strip malls and the super centers and things like that, get people out of their cars. In fact, when I was at Celebration last, they had special parking places for little cars that were rechargeable electric. So if you did have to get around, you know, you wouldn't have to have a parking problem, and you wouldn't have to be polluting at all. So this is happening everywhere. Some great examples of urban projects. Atlanta has a project called Atlantic Station where they converted an old steel mill property into a high-density development. You have Portland, Oregon, which has been doing some wonderful things with their downtown. And the key to all these things is to create an environment where people feel safe, where they can go from one place to the other, don't have to get into a car, and they have access to public transportation that's very close by. So that's always the key to these things.
We're speaking with John F. Wasek, and we're talking about his new book, The Cul-de-Sac Syndrome, Turning Around the Unsustainable American Dream. John, in your chapter titled Building Smarter, you cite the smart home of Michel Kaufman at the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago. What lessons can we learn from that and more recent innovations in terms of energy efficiency and just building a home smarter with better insulation that is a more pleasant but, you know, the bottom line, more efficient and more environmentally friendly place to live?
Well, one of the really important things that I took away from my exploration of the American home was that, you know, we're still using 19th century technology to build homes in the 21st century. We're stick building. We're doing 2x4s. We're pouring foundations. We're taking a lot of time to build a house. You take up, you know, 3 dumpsters worth of construction waste right to the landfill. It's incredibly wasteful. And what Michelle Kaufman has done, she does a lot of homes on the West Coast, and she was trying to build a company based on factory-built homes, is that you can build the home in modules. You build the homes in terms of rooms, in terms of sections, in terms of walls that already have the electrical and the HVAC and the plumbing, and everything's ready to go. And instead of doing a construction site, you're doing an assembly, and the term is buttoning up the house. So you take these modules on a flatbed truck, and I've seen it being constructed, or rather assembled, and it's set on the foundation in an afternoon. So instead of having, you know, 6 months' worth of workers and materials and just utter chaos for 6 months, 9 months out of the year, you have a home that can be set on the site in a matter of hours. This makes so much sense. And I predicted she would be like the Henry Ford of home building. Why can't we mass produce homes? And guess what? The price comes down the more you make them. You have economies of scale. You have a much tighter, greener house. It's going to be a better built house. And you don't have the waste. You're not sending, you know, all this drywall off to the landfill, and you have less greenhouse gas emission when you're doing this.
How much cheaper is a mass-produced house like this? I mean, in terms of percentage, is it? I guess it's not up and running enough, so we know eventually the economies of scale here. But what do you guess if something like this were to be constructed widely around the country? How much would we be saving?
Well, my guess was you could knock off about a third off the price of the home and about two-thirds off the time it takes to build it. So your savings are quite significant, and if you ever did this in a huge factory where you're exporting these to every part of the country and perhaps overseas, you'd be talking about cost coming down. Let me use this example. Let's say we're looking at cell phones. Look how much cell phones have come down in price and how much more they offer in terms of technology. You got a camera, you got a GPS unit, got internet access, all in this little device. And it all gets better every single year. Why can't homes be like that? Why can't they offer more technology? Why can't they be more energy efficient and use less power and less water? The answer is they can. We just need to provide some incentives to build these homes, to put them in factories, to put more people to work, and to really have places where we need to put them, like the inner cities, like the inner suburbs, places where affordable housing is just non-existent anymore.
What kinds of changes do we need to make in our public policy in order to encourage green building and higher density livable homes, the communities that you're talking about in terms of reinventing the neighborhoods so people don't have to go to the mall 15, 20 miles away, you know, to buy a lawnmower, whatever it is? What do we need to do?
Well, we clearly need a national model building code that says, look, here's the best practice for building a home. Here are the best standards we can think of that we should emulate. The LEED standard is a good start. That needs to be widespread, and that's put out by the U.S. Green Building Council. We have Energy Star standards. We have state standards. The National Association of Home Builders have standards. Let's have one national standard, put it in a model building code, and say, look, all you states and municipalities, let's rewrite our building codes. And here are some incentives. If you put in more green housing, you'll get more federal dollars for your community. If you do green developments, you'll get more federal dollars for infrastructure. Let's have a carrot and stick approach to this. We'll also need to do revisions of building codes so we have more mixed-use development. And to really encourage green building, it will have to be a permanent part of our national policy. I've been reading the climate change legislation that came out of the House, now going to the Senate, and there are some green building items in there. We need to have more of them, and we need to have them long-term, over the next 10 or 20 years if we're to be serious about this.
John, I was recently at a co-housing conference in Seattle, Washington, and I knew we were going to be doing this interview, and I was, you know, thinking the interrelationship between co-housing, a concept I explained a little bit to listeners last week, is an intentional community. A group of people get together, select a property, design it. There's a lot of concern and focus on energy efficiency and green building techniques, usually, and a group process for making decisions. But at the bottom line, the co-housing movement around the country, which is just getting started here, although it's pretty anchored incredibly well in Denmark, where I think a third of the people live in co-housing communities right now. But here in this country, you know, it seems to be the most important reason people are getting involved is because they want, as you said earlier tonight, they want to reinvent community, because so many of us, as we live in our neighborhoods, we don't even know who's living next door to us or the people down the street. You know, there's a lot of alienation from neighborhoods, particularly in the suburbs, where I think, you know, people don't feel part of a community, even though you're living side by side with people. But maybe you could just say a quick word about co-housing and what kind of solutions you see offered there through intentional communities.
Well, I have a couple friends who've participated in these communities, and I think it's a great idea. Unfortunately, it's antithetical to the American character. We're all rugged Jeffersonian individualists. We got to have our own little pieces of land and our big place in the sky and all these things that are part of the American mythology. But, you know, it's starting to make more sense, and I think we're getting to the point as a culture where we need to look at these things. Not everyone needs all this space. I constantly see these huge homes. I mean, you know, 10,000 square feet and it's two people living in it. And you're seeing all these McMansions being vacated and abandoned in some of the foreclosure alleys in California and Arizona and Florida. And it's just an incredible waste of space. And we need to put a better use of interior space and create it for more people. We can do this, but we have to take a little bit of a cultural paradigm shift and say, look, suppose we use the power of the Internet and we say to people, look, find somebody you think you might want to live with and communicate with them and do a Facebook or Twitter or something and actually meet them and say, look, you know, what if we share space here? You know, say you have a group of senior citizens or a group of widowers, a group of widows or people like that. It would make so much sense, and they could share costs, share resources, and it would be a better use of space. So we really need to get down that path. It's been done in Scandinavian countries because there's so much homogeneity in their cultures, but we need to bring people together, and through networking, social media, I think we can trigger it.
Well said, John. I guess lastly here, I want to just ask you about the window of time we're living in. It seems that with the housing crisis, the mortgage meltdown, we may be in a very narrow window of time where we can make some dramatic changes in public policy that would encourage greener construction, denser design of affordable housing, as well as just redesigning neighborhoods so people can go down to the local store and not have to take their car. What's the time frame we're living in? Do you feel an urgency here that we really need to act fast?
Well, I think we have a very, very decent window of opportunity now where, you know, we're looking at the housing crisis. It's going to take a couple of years to sort it out in some of the worst areas. There's a huge inventory of homes. I mean, there's no doubt about it, and there's not going to be a great spur in building activity anytime soon. Foreclosure crisis has not been really shut down, and it's gotten to be very complicated. But, you know, we have to look forward. We have to say, look, there's a better way of doing this. We can't go back to the 19th century way of building homes, and we can't go back to the sprawl-infested areas that just created more problems than they were worth. We have to say, look, this is an opportunity. This is the time to plan ahead, to really grab a hold of what we think is the American dream and redefine it. Maybe we don't need as much space. We certainly don't need to use as many resources as we do in the home. It's just a big receptacle for stuff, and it creates a lot of greenhouse gases, uses up a lot of water. I mean, you look at any suburban home, and they use hundreds of gallons a day. And it's water is a finite resource. We have to realize that. We have to look at watersheds. I went from the southeast to the northwest just looking at water issues, and I found out that almost a third of the country was in drought mode when I did my research. And it's not getting any better with climate change. You know, some places are going to get more water, some less. And it's going to be catastrophic because you can't replace groundwater that fast. Surface water is limited as well. Only so much is going to fall from the sky. So we have to say, look, let's see where we're at. Let's look at our use of resources and see how we can do this much better.
Well, John, we're out of time, but I thank you so much for joining us tonight and talking about this important work, your recent book, The Cul-de-Sac Syndrome, Turning Around the Unsustainable American Dream. People can get it and take a look at some of the alternatives to the very wasteful way that we live and construct homes, and a vision for what we could do differently, both as individuals and as a country, as a society. So thanks so much, John. Is there a website for the book that our listeners can go to?
Sure, it's pretty simple. It's cul-de-sac-syndrome.com. That's cul-de-sac-syndrome.com, cul-de-sac-syndrome.com.
All right. Well, again, thanks for writing the book and all your work on this topic, John, and appreciate you making time for us tonight.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
Take care. Bye-bye. That was John F. Wasik, an award-winning personal finance columnist with Bloomberg News, and again, his new book, The Cul-de-Sac Syndrome. That does it for us tonight on this program. We'll be back next Monday evening with another edition of Counterpoint. We hope you'll join us then. In the meantime, go to our website, WPKN.org. Find out about our schedule, how you can volunteer here at the listener-sponsored radio station, and make an online contribution, a secure online contribution, to help us pay the bills here and maintain our independence. So with that said, thanks you all for listening, and JF is up next, and we'll leave you with some music from the Gang of Four.
between our work and its product.